Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio, Season 1, Episode 4, Holding the Fire in Chisasibi. I'm Chuck, your occasionally questionable guide to the roads most folks politely decline. Today we begin our northern run toward James Bay, a 1,300-mile stretch to the end of a long and lonely road where the land grows quiet and ends at the southernmost extent of the Arctic Ocean, where the people have been holding the fire long before we ever showed up. Let's get into it. Some trips sneak up on you. You think you're just driving north, and then a quiet moment happens. Small, human. And suddenly, the place feels bigger than the road that brought you there. This is one of those moments. Thump, thump, clank. Every few seconds, the Jeep jumped another frost-heaved trough, scattering spoons, coins, and my lower spine. Somewhere under the seat, a tent stake and an old socket danced in some sort of Bermuda Triangle of lost gear. We'd been at it for hours, 9 vehicles strung out across northern Quebec, each driver trying to find that one smooth line that didn't exist. The radio had been quiet for an hour. That eerie silence you get right before something goes sideways. Then, it squelched alive with a quick and simple, "Pathfinder, Yellow Cig just lost a wheel." I looked in my mirror at the empty road. That's never good. I doubled back. I found Kevin, call sign Yellowcake, rolling his rogue tire back toward the white SUV it had just left. This wasn't your everyday flat. The wheel had parted ways with the vehicle completely. We gathered around, all of us still a little shocked. No broken studs, just 5 lug nuts that had worked themselves off. Easy enough fix if anyone carried spare lugs 600 miles from the nearest Napa store. And Doug did. Naturally, that's why we call him Napa. After a chorus of jacks and shovels, we had the rig fixed and ready again. The rest of us quietly tightened our own lugs. Suddenly, ensuring our tires were secure was important. I guess humility comes fast on the James Bay Road. Now, the James Bay Road isn't just long, it's alone. 620 kilometers of pavement running from Matagami to the edge of the Arctic Ocean. No towns, no gas for hundreds of miles, no cell signal. There was literally no civilization. It was carved out of the wilderness in the early 1970s by crews racing to build hydro dams for Quebec's growing cities. 450 miles of wilderness highway in 450 days. Out here, the taiga turns thin, half bog, half forest. The only thing you really hear is your own engine. By mid-afternoon, we reached the checkpoint at Matagami, kilometer zero, the official gateway to nowhere. If you read the internet stories from people who ventured this far, you'd expect the place to look like a Cold War outpost. Armed guards, floodlights, maybe a guy in mirrored sunglasses. In reality, it's a double-wide trailer with a gravel parking lot and a sign that looks hand-painted by someone who ran out of red paint. It said, "Bienvenue." At this checkpoint, you usually pull up to a metal speaker that looks like it last worked in the 50s. A voice crackles through without enthusiasm. "Name." Most folks dutifully comply, mumble something through the static and get a thank you, and drive off wondering what just happened. It seems that this checkpoint exists less to monitor travelers than to maintain the illusion that someone cares where you're going. We decided to go inside, because that's what explorers do when there's a door. Inside, the attendant seemed startled that someone actually took the time to walk in at all. He handed us pamphlets and a free road guide with no ceremony. He jotted down my alias, slid a map across the counter, and said, "Good luck." We stepped back outside in the cold sunlight, slightly disappointed that no alarms went off. There's a place about halfway up the James Bay Road called Relais Routier, and that basically means truck stop or roadhouse in French. At Relais Routier, the pumps were hid behind the building like they were embarrassed, and inside the staff switched between French, English, and Cree mid-sentence. We gassed up, got a snack, and got back on the road. And after that, the conversation dried up. Even the engine noise seemed to fade. Somewhere past kilometer 500, the silence changed. It wasn't just the remoteness that got to me, it was the history under the road. The farther we went, the more I thought about the people who'd lived here long before the road existed, long before anyone asked them if they wanted visitors. I'd read about the Canadian residential schools, families separated, languages punished out of existence. I thought about how many times men who looked like me had shown up in places like this claiming to improve things. I didn't know the full story of the hydro project yet. That revelation would come later. But even then, I could feel the weight of the past riding along with us. Our destination was Fort George. It sits at the mouth of the La Grande River, an island community where the Cree had lived for generations. When Hydro-Québec dammed the river, the engineers predicted the island would erode and flood. The community was relocated to the mainland, and that community was called Chisasibi, Great River. Only the engineers were wrong. The old island never washed away. It's still there, quiet, stubborn, and completely intact. We moved them to save them from a flood that never came. That line kept looping in my head as the kilometers ticked down. By the time we reached Chisasibi, it was Saturday night. The place was still. No one on the streets. No noise but the wind. For a minute, it felt deserted. Then I remembered. The Cree spend their weekends with family, not in town. The pavement ended at a gravel beach lined with freighter canoes pulled high above the tide. Beyond that lay James Bay, gray, endless. We'd driven 1,300 miles to reach the end of the road, and somehow it still didn't feel like the destination. A quiet little celebration broke out at the shoreline, feet in the Arctic Ocean, mission accomplished. I stepped in too, mostly to share the moment, but I couldn't shake the sense that everyone else thought we'd reached the peak. To them, this was the finish line. To me, it felt like a threshold. We weren't done. We'd only crossed the doorway. Something in my gut told me the real trip hadn't even started yet. We pitched tents beside an open picnic shelter, park-like and awkward, forgotten, a lonely monument to some long-ago effort to make the place feel managed. We searched the thin taiga behind the shelter for firewood, coaxed a small fire to life, and gathered around its dim glow. When headlights appeared in the distance, crawling toward us, conversation stopped. The beam swayed like a ship at sea. Out here, visitors weren't common, and we all knew we hadn't asked permission to camp here. By the time the pickup rolled to a stop, we'd reached a silent agreement to face whatever came. The truck door opened, and instead of authority, out stepped a man with a smile that said he was entirely at home. "I'm Robert. I watched the boats." I immediately asked him, "Who do we ask permission to camp here?" He waved a hand. "This is my land, our land, your land. You can stay here." Then came a soft chuckle, the kind that doesn't expect laughter in return. We offered what we had. Kevin handed him a jalapeno and cheese sausage. "What is it?" he asked. He tried to say jalapeno with an air of curiosity. He stumbled on those syllables, but then chuckled and took a bite. The heat caught him off guard. His eyes watered slightly, his lips tightened, and still he smiled. "Good." He held that sausage for 20 minutes before finishing it, one cautious bite at a time. Watching him, I realized this was more than politeness. He was accepting something foreign and unpleasant, because that's what his people had always done to welcome outsiders. Then it struck me. This quiet grace, this instinct to accommodate, was the same gentle strength that once left them open to the harm visitors could bring. "They moved our people there from the island. Said the dam would wash it away." He shrugged lightly. "But the island's still there. Never went anywhere." As we talked, I mentioned Cape Jones. His eyebrows lifted. "Long ways, way up." Not a warning, not sarcasm, just acknowledgement. Then we sat around the fire, talking, then silent. The tide slipped away, revealing more shore, like the whole place was leaning in. For the first time on the trip, I wasn't thinking about road conditions or fuel stops. Just the quiet grace of sitting on ground that didn't need to forgive me, but did anyways. When Robert finally stood, he smiled again. "My wife will worry if I don't go home now. Enjoy your night." His taillights disappeared into the dark. The fire settled. For a moment, none of us spoke. We just stared at the fading glow of his truck. Part relief, part awe, then the realization. We had just stepped into something bigger. Most of the group hadn't wandered far from home before this trip, and you could see it in their faces. This wasn't tourism anymore. This was immersion. Something genuine had brushed up against us. For a moment, the whole place felt different, and somewhere out there were a people who were still here, holding the fire. That night in Chisasibi was the true beginning of our James Bay journey. The road ended, and something older, quieter, and warmer took its place. This is just the first story of the North. There's more ahead. Fort George, Cape Jones, and the wild coastline beyond. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and may you always find someone holding the fire when your road runs out.